DW Africa Link.
Imagine you and your family fleeing a violent war, running for your lives from a place you once called home, now forced to settle in a neighboring state as refugees with no clear vision of the future. The truth is, for many people, it's not a choice. It's a situation they are faced with, forced to run away from war, natural disasters, or persecution. Chad, in Central Africa, hosts more than 1 million refugees. The majority of them are from Sudan. So how is it for these refugees, and what's the connection between politics and refugees? That's what's coming up. I am Eddie Micah Jr., and you are welcome to Africa Link, the podcast connecting you to the stories that matter from Africa and beyond.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
It has been classified as one of the worst crises in the world. The conflict in Sudan began more than a year ago. Two military groups inside the country, that is the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, RSF, have been fighting. And the war has been brutal, with civilians caught in the middle of a power struggle. The World Health Organization estimates that around 16,000 people have been killed and at least 33,000 injured. The war has also displaced more than 9 million people and left some 5 million on the brink of famine. Some analysts describe it as the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
War rages in Sudan as the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces fight the government for control of the country. The contested western region of Darfur has been a major flashpoint, still scarred by a genocide that took place 20 years ago, also committed by militias. Multiple attempts by the US to stop the fighting have failed, as both sides seem to still think they can win.
Hundreds are killed and thousands are forced to flee. Life has become unbearable for those who remained in the city. Having the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces extremely restricting and hampering aid.
It can be described as truly scorched earth. Members of non-Arab minorities, namely the Fur, the Zaghawa, and the Masalit, are killed systematically.
Our lives have become difficult. Now, as you can see, we don't have anything, not even dinner, to make for my kids. We came from Tawila. We had to leave at night. We could not leave during the day because we were scared of strikes and heavy weapons.
Most of those fleeing have now become refugees in neighboring Chad. For more on this, let's bring in Carl Schembri of the Norwegian Refugee Council.
So I've met women who have been gang raped, whose husbands were killed in front of them, whose houses and villages have been burned to the ground, and walked for hours on end to get to the border and cross into Chad. These are people fleeing from Darfur, where there's not just now, over the last week, there's been another uptick in violence over there, more people displaced. So already they are fleeing from the unthinkable. A lot of the men were targeted for executions. A lot of the women were targeted with sexual violence. And that's the tragic disaster that's unfolding over there. Now, they are fleeing to an extremely impoverished country, which is itself, first of all, being one of them being Chad. There are others fleeing to South Sudan, another very impoverished country. Egypt has better resources, but still has a lot of problems of its own. So they are fleeing to extremely difficult situations. In Chad, in particular, the place where they fled to, the border area, is devoid of anything, of any infrastructure. There's children who are Chadians who have never been to school. There are very, very few, if any, medical facilities. Most of the medical facilities run there are run by the MSF, the Medicine Sans Frontières. The cruel irony is I've met children who are telling me our daily life was waking up, going to school, walk to school, it was as long as it was safe, and coming back, playing with my friends. Now they are in an area where there are no schools.
What they do have, at least, is the guarantee of staying alive, because otherwise, being in Sudan, there would be no guarantee of staying alive, right?
They have the safety, yes. They have the relative safety, which was what the only reason why they went there. I wouldn't be too smug on that either, because on the border, every border that we work in every crisis is porous, right? So there's always some of the armed groups coming in, some of the soldiers going out. So it's not guaranteed.
Is Chad able to take care of the refugees? Or to what extent are they able to do that?
Oh, Chad needs all the support possible. So Chad has been extremely generous in allowing, as it should, all the refugees who need asylum, who need safety, who need protection, and they did the right thing. But the international community needs to follow up in its support, in its solidarity for Chad, for South Sudan, for all the countries around Sudan, which are taking in these people, bearing in mind that humanitarian aid is not, when you consider the immediate impact that it has in saving lives immediately, it is not that costly. And we need bigger picture, the political involvement of the countries with influence that can put an end to this madness, because it keeps deteriorating, it keeps getting worse for the people both in Sudan and the outside.
So if it's that challenging for Chad to take care of all these refugees, it's fair to ask, why does Chad keep receiving refugees from Sudan?
Well, first of all, because Chad rightly has left the border open, as is also required of every country which has a neighbor where there is distress, this kind of conflict, of crisis. I guess if I had to paraphrase a bit your question, why do people keep fleeing to Chad? Is that they are in one of the biggest hotspots of the Sudan war. We are talking about the west, which is the Darfur bordering with Chad. And Darfur is one of the most violent hotspots that we've seen. Lately, it's been not just the conflict. By lately, I mean the last 3-4 months, people have been fleeing from extreme hunger. That is the latest cruel, catastrophic update, if you like, to this story. It hasn't been declared yet purely for reason of figures, of data. We don't have the critical mass to call it a famine. People are dying of hunger.
Right. In your experience, because you rightfully so mentioned other neighboring countries to Sudan, and yet we're saying, you know, quite a number of them also go to Chad. I mean, there's also Egypt, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda. Are these countries taking in enough, in your estimate?
They are taking in whoever turns up, most of them. I think Egypt less so, and that should be the minimum, right? That should be the minimum policy of any country that is witnessing such a thing next door. Countries like Uganda, which has been historically extremely generous with refugees, it's taken refugees from everywhere. And yet Uganda is witnessing massive, massive funding cuts in aid, in humanitarian aid, which is compromising its position. It wouldn't be unthinkable to see Uganda changing its policy given the pressures it's going through, and we have to avoid that at all costs. There is a wealthier part of the world, there is an influential part of the world that can step in, that has to step in and help in these moments. These are also, just to remind also a bit to our listeners, these are issues that are also affecting the rest of the world. If we had to be slightly selfish about this, forget our humanity for a second. I've met people from Sudan in Chad who know, have relatives, have friends, who have already taken the very dangerous route to the Mediterranean. They've crossed to Libya, they've tried crossing the sea from Sudan, imagine, so as far back as Sudan. So this has an impact on the rest of the world.
Right, rightfully so. You seem to be pointing fingers at the wider international community to do a lot more to,
you know, first of all, prevent these conflicts from raging on, and in the refugee situation, for them to do even more to protect and take care of refugees. So it seems to me that there's a lot of politics being, you know, involved in all of this. Can you help me connect this? How does local or international politics influence the decision-making process of, you know, who to receive as a refugee, when to receive them as refugees, how refugees are treated? What's the connection there?
Every country makes its own decisions on who can enter, when and how. But they, many countries subscribe to the Refugee Convention. They are signatories. They are part of that body which is meant to regulate how you behave in such situations. Now, we're seeing, I mean, the dynamic of the Sudan war, given how big Sudan is itself, to help these people, there needs to be the required funding for the local authorities to help them. They need to be supported. We're not seeing any of that. It is quite astonishing, really.
How do we deal with that? Where's the accountability? Who is there to make sure that people are respecting international law?
Well, now you're really touching on a raw nerve there, because that is the question, right? When we are constantly, I would say, undermined by Western countries, by much wealthier countries, not just in the West, that's the Gulf countries, that's all sorts of other countries, India, which could be doing so much more. And then we expect countries that are in the thick of it, which are so much worse, we expect them to keep taking on, keep policing for the doing the dirty work, if you like. I would never call it dirty work. This is about fundamental human rights. But you know what I mean, taking in the immediate influx of people and keeping them away from right. Europe, keeping them away from North America, from the rest of the world. It does undermine all our advocacy efforts that we do with these authorities to keep being generous, to keep their borders open. It is a glaring double standard. We get to see which lives matter. It is a very tragic, I think, turn of events. I think over the last decade, we've seen a rise of impunity, which is the direct responsibility of those on the ground, the armed people, the people with weapons killing and chasing people away. And of course, there is the complete political abdication of responsibility by the surrounding countries, by the neighboring countries, and the world powers, the United Nations. We've seen a couple of resolutions on Sudan, which mean nothing on the ground.
You don't sound optimistic at all that the situation will get any better than refugees.
With particular reference to Sudan, my biggest hope and source of optimism is the people. The Sudanese people have called and clamored for what is their right for the last years, and they will keep doing it. So there is hope. We owe it to them, only to them, and to our colleagues, our heroic Sudanese colleagues on the ground, those who are left, because a few of them had to also escape to other countries. We need to keep supporting them. We need to keep raising their voices and trying to get the attention that they need, because they truly deserve it, like everyone else.
What is going to be your call to the wider international community and all those listening now that is needed to make sure that refugees are well protected and taken care of?
Three very basic points. Step up the funding. It doesn't require much, but it will have a direct, immediate impact. It will save lives. Get the parties to the conflict to seriously sit down, negotiate, mediate between them, get them to respect the civilians, and use all the influence you have. And there is influence. There are parties that could be exerting their influence to stop this, and instead they are fueling the fire to this conflict. So that is an extra responsibility that some countries have. You can use that actually to do the opposite, to do good. We actually need ceasefires. We need aid is being impeded. Aid is being stopped from being distributed across Sudan by the parties to this conflict. That is a man-made decision which is costing lives. That can be changed. So there are immediate things that could be done.
Carl Schembri of the Norwegian Refugee Council, thank you very much for your time.
Abuja, Nairobi, Harare. Africa Link's correspondents bring African stories to you.
As we have just heard, Chad is hardly the only African country dealing with a significant refugee crisis. Cameroon also hosts over 500,000 displaced people from neighboring countries. Not just that, they are also dealing with internally displaced people due to the ongoing Anglophone crisis, which began around 2016. We will explain that in a bit as we welcome my colleague Blaise Young. He is DW's correspondent in Cameroon. Hello, Blaise. How are you doing?
I am good. Nice to hear from you, Eddie. It's been a while.
On the topic of refugees moving from countries of conflict and how they're being treated, Cameroon in itself has almost, what, about 500,000 refugees in the country right now. Give us a sense of who are they, where are they coming from, how are they getting in?
Oh, so Cameroon is bordered with about 5 African countries. And so you have a lot of refugees coming in from Nigeria. I think we all have heard of the Boko Haram insurgency in northern Nigeria. And Cameroon has a very long border from north to south in the western section of Cameroon. So the entire western section of Cameroon's border is covered with Nigeria. So the insurgency in the northern part of Nigeria caused by the Boko Haram and also kidnapping. So you have a lot of people fleeing that and crossing over to Cameroon, especially in the northern part of Cameroon. Every day you have people fleeing when there are attacks of bandits in Nigeria, when schools and people are abducted. We are also bordered with the Central African Republic, which is also a country that is plagued with instability. And so you have Central African Republic refugees from the Central African Republic fleeing into Cameroon from the eastern part of our borders. And also you have a conflict in the Lake Chad Basin. And so you have people coming in from Chad. Recently, when there was elections in Chad, and even before that, when there are conflicts also, you have refugees that are coming into Cameroon.
Mm. So just to be clear, when you say refugees coming in, how are they coming in?
The borders are not very sophisticated. So a lot of people cross through the bushes, the forest. So sometimes they take motorbikes and then get to a certain point, and then they have to continue the journey by foot. And then at some point, maybe they have to bought vehicles to cross over. That's for those who can afford. Because I remember when I went to the north to see refugees from Nigeria, some of them, the story that they told DW, that some of them came by foot, some who could afford came by car, some came by motorbike. The same is true for Chadian refugees. The same is true for refugees from the Central African Republic.
Right, right. And we keep hearing that refugees face also challenging situations in their host country. What are you following in Cameroon? How are they perceived? How are they treated? What are their conditions in the camps they are in?
I think in Cameroon, the main issue they have is land. You know, when refugees come in, they are kept in host communities. So these camps from UNHCR and other UN agency, these camps are in villages. So they are in host communities, and so there's always this conflict of land because some of these refugees come from communities where they were farmers themselves, or they were they own livestock, and so because they've come to a new community, there's often conflict between the host community and host communities and the refugees who are struggling to kind of rebuild their lives, to kind of cultivate crops and breed their animals. But sometimes people in host communities see them as strangers who have come, and they have come to take their land and their fields to graze.
Cameroon is in quite a unique situation where you also have a lot of internally displaced people because of the Anglophone crisis going on. First off, just briefly for those that want to get a better understanding of what we mean by the Anglophone crisis, can you briefly explain that to us and how people, victims that are internally displaced from that, are also being treated in the country?
Cameroon has two official languages because Cameroon has two sections. So there's a section of Cameroon, which is about 20% of the country, which is purely English speaking, and the rest, 80%, is purely French speaking. It goes back to the Second World War and how the British and the French administered Cameroon as one country but two systems. And therefore, the Anglophone crisis or conflict comes from the fact that the Anglophones, who are the minority in the country, feel that they have been marginalized by the majority Francophone government, led government. And so you have, in 2016, a group of disgruntled Anglophone lawyers and teachers started protest. And I think a lot of analysts have said the government did not handle the conflict, the crisis at the time, properly. And a year after, a more radical group of Anglophones took up arms and started attacking police stations. And so from that, there has been a displacement of a lot of Anglophones internally, as you've mentioned. But also, a lot of Anglophones have also fled to Nigeria because, as I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, Cameroon has a long border with Nigeria, and the Anglophones are close to Nigeria, and they have a similar culture and speak the same language. So you have a lot of Cameroon refugees, Anglophones, who've crossed over to Nigeria. But there are also a lot of internally displaced people who do not stay in camps, who fled their villages, who fled their small towns, and most of them have moved to the French part of Cameroon because the conflict is taking place in the English part of Cameroon, where scores of villages have been burned down, farmlands have been taken sometimes by the separatists, and also the army sometimes raid communities.
How is the Cameroonian government dealing with these internally displaced people?
You would see that in the beginning, the government was handing out a few buckets, bars of soaps, mattresses, rice, and things like that. I would tell you, as someone who has been staying in the Anglophone region, that you don't see any of that anymore. So the internally displaced people have been abandoned in themselves, and so they have to adapt. I think for a lot of the people, you know, everybody has to fend for themselves at this point. You have a few international NGOs that would stop by and make some donations to these internally displaced people, but it's barely enough.
Is there any difference between how internally displaced people in Cameroon are treated compared to, you know, people that flee from neighboring countries inside Cameroon?
There's a difference, but I think they are all victims of some form of discrimination. The people that come from other countries are seen as strangers who have come to take the land from host communities. And so that's the conflict. That's the point of conflict. For the internally displaced people, for example, for the Anglophones, when they move to the French-speaking part of Cameroon, there have been cases on local television, local media, where local politicians, local supporters of government would go on television and saying the reason why there's an increase in crime wave in the capital, Yaoundé, for example, is because of the Anglophones who have invaded our cities. So you see people in their own country who have been forced to move out of their villages and their communities by conflict, are accused, you know, of being a nuisance. And some of them, you know, there's xenophobic words against the Anglophones.
Right. But that should not stop the government or indeed NGOs or the international community to still provide for whether internally displaced or for those that have fled war conflict from other countries and are now in Cameroon, right? It shouldn't stop them from giving them humanitarian aid.
Yeah, it shouldn't. I think, Eddie, I have because of the coverage, we've done extensive work covering the humanitarian crisis in Cameroon, both for the refugees who've come from other countries and people within the IDPs. Cameroon, as you would know, is ranked as one of the most neglected conflicts, the Anglophone crisis, one of the most neglected conflicts in the world. So a lot of NGOs, including UNHCR, during interviews will say, we do not have enough money. We do not have enough money to cater for these people, because I think the world simply doesn't pay much attention to Cameroon. I guess some of our viewers will be hearing about this Anglophone conflict for the first time, because the world simply seems to not pay much attention. So for the IDPs, they are struggling. Because everywhere you look, you would find someone who has come from another town, another village, and you would hardly see them getting help, either from government or from the international organization. I think for the international organizations, they do not have enough funding to cover everybody. I think for the government, I think there's a point, in my personal opinion, I think there's a neglect.
That's it from this edition of Africa Link. Join the conversation on our Facebook page, DW Africa. Listen to us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. Click follow so you don't miss an episode. This show was produced by Kai Nebe, and I am Eddie Maika Jr. Thanks for listening.
DW. Made for Minds.